Safety Subcommittee, Thursday, February 3rd, 2005. The agenda is a discussion with the Department of Justice, House Bill 5044. We will hear this afternoon members from the Appellate Division and Defense of Criminal Convictions. Mary Williams, the Oregon Solicitor General, will make that presentation, followed by the Child Support Division and Cindy Chinnock, Division Director, followed by Administrative Services Division, and Frank Hesha, Division Director, will make that presentation, followed by Attorney Billing Rate. And we will be hearing from Margot Norton, Administrative Services Division. And then, time permitting, we will hear a diversity presentation, agency priorities, and wrap up with the Attorney General Hardy Myers and the Associate Attorney General Leslie Kolish. That's a lot for this agenda, and we may find ourselves putting some things over. But let's get started and let the record note that we're starting without a quorum this afternoon. Good afternoon.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee. I'm Mary Williams. I'm the Solicitor General, which means that I'm responsible for the work of the Appellate Division in the Department of Justice. And where I want to start is with the mission of the Appellate Division. Our responsibility is to advocate the state's interest in state and federal appellate courts. And what I'd like to do today is to give you a sense of what that means day-to-day for the work that we do. We break that mission down into three goals, and two of them are on this slide. The first two are based on understanding what the role of the appellate courts are. And they have essentially two jobs that they're trying to accomplish. They're trying to resolve cases and also to announce what the law is for the state. And we keep both of those functions in mind when we set the goals for the division. So one of our goals is to win cases. We want to win on behalf of the state. But sometimes a more important goal is to recognize that law announcing function of the appellate courts and to do our best so that when the appellate courts announce what the law is, that reflects what we believe is in the best interest of the state. And occasionally those two collide, and it may be more important for us to get a good statement of the law in a case, even if we don't win the case. And sometimes winning isn't really the main goal for us, although I'll admit that there are times when winning is the only goal that we really have. Last month I argued in the Oregon Supreme Court a case involving the calculation of the 2001 kicker. And if we lose that case, that puts you in the hole another $113 million plus. And in a case like that, winning is what matters, and if the law looks a little rough around the edges when we're all done, we'll take that too. But the third goal, it isn't actually on this slide, but is very important for how we organize ourselves and how we do business, is to have the best appellate attorneys in the state who are able to handle any case that comes through our doors, not just today, but 5 years from now and 10 years from now. And if you look at our organization chart, we're organized a bit differently than the other legal divisions you've heard about. We're a very small division. And instead of being divided up into sections or units, we work as a team. So all of the attorneys and staff who work in the appellate division do a variety of cases. We have attorney managers who are responsible for different categories of cases, but we don't compartmentalize what kind of work the attorneys do and the staff do as much as what you'll see with the other legal divisions. And in part, that's to help us meet that third goal, that everyone works as a team, looking for ways to maximize our efficiency in doing our work, and often that's through centralization, specialization. But we balance that with a focus on training and development, especially for our less experienced attorneys, so that we're bringing them along and that they're able to handle whatever comes in the door for us in the future. And I'll talk more about what some of these attorneys, the attorneys in charge, do as we describe some of our cases. As far as positions, we have currently 49 FTE. That would go up to 49.5 in the recommended budget. And I think now we can go to the...
Madam Chair.
of Representative Hanna.
Could you just give us a rough breakdown of how many of those FTEs are legal attorneys and how many are staff?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, we have, there are six attorney managers, including myself, and those are the ones you'll see on that chart. We have, there are 30 line attorneys, and those are not all full FTE, but there are 30 attorneys. There are two paralegals, two support staff managers, and then the rest are support staff positions.
Okay. Thank you.
Where we fit in the department's overall budget, we are about 4% of the expenditures, $10.19 million. So we are a small piece of that pie. One of the most important things to know about the appellate division, and you heard from Tim Wood yesterday in describing the trial division, that this is true for him also, we are very reactive. 95% of our caseload is a results because somebody else has initiated a case in the appellate courts. In only 5% of our cases is it a decision that we have made to take a case to the appellate courts. If we don't react in the cases, I'll talk a bit more about the effect of us not being in those cases, but it goes back to what I was describing as our goals. It means that when the appellate courts announce the law, they will be less likely to do it in a way that really benefits the state. There will not be an advocate in the appellate courts for you and what you have intended in passing laws. And the wasting money is because often the cases get remanded or sent back to an earlier phase of the case to start over again. And that is not a good use of resources if we're able to resolve it otherwise in the appellate courts. Most of the work that we do is that we write briefs and argue cases. I said we are in both the state and the federal appellate courts, and I'll talk a bit more about what I mean writing briefs. But in the Court of Appeals, we are a party in approximately 80% of their cases, so we're certainly one of their most frequent parties. In the Oregon Supreme Court, we're there in 50 to 60% of the cases, and I think that number is actually increasing. In January, the Supreme Court heard arguments in 19 cases, and we were in 15 of those, which actually takes us up to 79%. We're a very small player in the federal appellate courts. We don't have very many cases that are in the federal appellate courts, but we're one of the most significant parties in the state appellate courts. Much of our work comes from the district attorney's offices in criminal cases. After the district attorneys have handled the trial and the case is on appeal, we then take over the handling, the representing of the state in those cases. And we'll talk more about that when we talk about defense of criminal convictions. Our other cases, though, can come from any of the other divisions that you've already heard described for the Department of Justice. They may be cases that were handled by the trial division or civil enforcement. They may have come from agency actions where a general counsel attorney was involved in helping the agency. And then some cases come because the legislature has mandated that we do the work. And the biggest example of that is the ballot titles. We write and defend the ballot titles. And there may be other cases where, as part of the legislation, you require that challenges to a piece of legislation go straight to the appellate courts. And so we're involved in those cases. Very briefly, the kinds of cases, again, they're everything you've heard about so far in Department of Justice, criminal cases, civil, administrative. I'll tell you a little bit more about what the other kinds of cases are on another slide. Quickly, on the criminal cases, there are different categories, and I'll talk about those when we talk about defense of criminal convictions. But the criminal cases that you see listed here are just over about half of our workload, and those are general fund cases. All the rest of the cases are other fund cases that are paid for by the agencies that we represent in those cases.
Ms. Williams, I need to stop you there just for a moment to note for the record that we now have a quorum, and Senator Winters is excused. Please go forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Civil cases are many of the cases that you've heard described previously, the tort cases that are handled by the trial division. Termination of parental rights cases are a very important category for us. There are a small number of cases, but they take a lot of our resources because of the size of the record. And they're also cases that we have a strong interest in moving quickly through the system because children's lives hang in the balance on those. And so there are cases that we, as we have to make decisions about prioritizing cases, those are one of our top priorities. State habeas corpus, what that means is a challenge to conditions of confinement by inmates. And then obviously the challenges to statutes and initiatives are a very important part of what we do. The administrative cases are cases that come through agency action where there may have been a contested case hearing. And then after that, a party who's dissatisfied with that can have judicial review in the appellate courts. The other kinds of cases we have are some of those original jurisdiction cases that I mentioned where the legislature has said that review will be direct in the Oregon appellate courts. The most recent example last session was the public employees retirement system where the review of that new legislation was direct to the Oregon Supreme Court. And the redistricting we see every 10 years, and again, that's one where the review is direct in the appellate courts. Mandamus are cases where someone wants the court to order a public official to take some action or stop taking some action. And those may begin in the trial courts, or some of them, depending on who they want to take the action, will begin in the Oregon Supreme Court. And we've recently had kind of a fair number of these involving jury list requests in criminal cases, especially in death penalty cases, where what they're asking is for the trial court to direct the public official to take some action, and that's what mandamus involves. Ballot titles we've mentioned. Amicus cases are amicus means friend of the court, and it's a brief that is done in a case where the state is not a party to the case but has an interest in the case and wants the court to be aware of the state's interest in the way it resolves the case and in the way it announces the law. So what does this mean on a day-to-day basis for us? This next slide gives an overview of the typical appellate case. When a case comes into our office, one of the manager who's responsible for that kind of case will review the case. And the case always starts, we're very color coordinated in the appellate courts. So we always start with a blue brief that comes in. The blue brief will outline all of the challenges that the person has to the action that they're challenging. The manager for that kind of case reviews it and will write a very brief description of the issues in the case, what some of our responses are likely to be, and then we assign that case to one of our line attorneys. The line attorney will spend time reviewing the issues, reviewing the file, researching the issues, and then will write a brief for the state, and the respondent's briefs are always read. And I will say that brief is a misnomer. Most of these cases, these are not brief, and in fact, very few of them live up to their name. But the average brief, I think, is probably around 38 pages, and it's actually one of the things we track as we try to keep track of complexity of cases. We keep track of how many pages we're putting out. Once the cases have been briefed, the appellate court will set the case for oral argument. And in the Court of Appeals right now, that typically means about 2 to 3 months after the cases have been briefed, they'll be scheduled for an oral argument. The attorneys appear. Argument is also a bit of a misnomer. It's actually usually a very polite discussion with the attorneys and the appellate judges. And after that, then we wait for a court decision. Depending on how the court decision turns out, if you're in the Court of Appeals, either side who's unhappy with the decision has an opportunity to ask the Oregon Supreme Court to review the case. But that's discretionary with the Oregon Supreme Court, and they have the ability to say no and to decide which cases that they'll hear, with the exception of some cases that you've mandated that they consider. If we do not win in the Court of Appeals, or sometimes if we win but we don't think that the statement of law is a good statement of law, we will meet as a committee to decide whether the case is something that we should ask the Supreme Court to review. And we've started paying more attention, actually, to that decision point, as looking at how we do the petitions for review in the Supreme Court and making a real effort to spend more time on that training and development component of working with our newer attorneys. And that's really paid off. In 2003, we prepared 14 petitions for review. The Supreme Court allowed 4 of those and denied 10, so a success rate for us of 29%. In 2004, we prepared 21 petitions. The court allowed 17 of those and denied 4. So our success rate is now up to 81%. And just this week, actually, the court allowed two more petitions that we had prepared in 2004. So that focus on not only getting the work done, but looking ahead at making sure that we have really top quality appellate staff to handle cases in the future, I think pays off, and that's a nice example of it. One other thing I want to mention before we move on, sorry Kevin, if you back up, before we move off of this, there have been historically places in the appellate system where there was flexibility in the system, and primarily that was in the amount of time that it would take us to review the file, research the issues, and prepare the brief. And we could take extensions in the appellate court and in the Supreme Court and ask for additional time. So as pressure builds up in one particular area, we were able to stretch out the time it would take us to deal with other cases, and we could kind of keep the system moving along pretty smoothly. What's happened as a result of cuts to the division for the current biennium is that we've used up that flexibility in the system. The time it takes us now for a case to go from being assigned to being filed with the court has gotten to the point where there's very little give left in the system, either because of there's an increased number of cases that have to be expedited, where we simply cannot take additional time, and also because the cases where we are able to take the additional time, we're getting to the point where we're reaching an outer limit, either because the court is needing to say to us, you cannot have more time, we've got to move these cases along, or because we look at it and it simply is not fair to the participants who are involved in the matter, that case isn't going to be resolved in a timely way. And in some of our cases, that's a considerable amount of time. We're looking at a year of the case being assigned in our office and before it's actually going to be briefed, which is just a piece of this system. And there's additional time involved, obviously, when we're waiting for argument and waiting for a decision. And so there is a point where it simply isn't right to stretch the cases out anymore. And what we've now used up in our system is that flexibility. Now we're going to move to some numbers and data. Like I have said, we don't actually assign attorneys to working on particular caseloads, but if you break out the hours that we work, the breakdown is that approximately two-thirds of our staff time is devoted to criminal work, and the other third to civil and administrative work. And on average, an attorney can resolve 40 to 50 cases in a year.
Representative Hannah.
Thank you. With the manager attorneys then, if there's 6 of them and 30 folks, they're each managing 5 attorneys in their group on average. So those 6 folks aren't calculated into the numbers?
Madam Chair, Representative Hannah, the managing attorneys don't just manage. They're also appellate attorneys who, and it works a little odd to try to fit them into this. We kind of take the time that they're supposed to be devoted to legal work as opposed to management work and count that as part of the FTE that's devoted to the actual workload that we do. And many of our managers they're expected to do about half of their time doing legal work. For some of them, it's considerably more than that, and for others, it ends up being less than that, depending, again, on sort of where the pressure is greatest in the system. But our managers carry a pretty heavy caseload themselves.
Can I follow up?
Certainly.
As it pertains to that, is there data from private sector, many of us are looking at this for the first time in terms of what kind of caseload. Can you substantiate that for us with private industry data from the legal standpoint?
Madam Chair, Representative Hannah, there are very few people in the state who do full-time appellate work. Frankly, it's one of the things that enables us to attract really good appellate attorneys is we're one of the few places where you get to do appellate work all the time, and those of us who love a pellet work, that's a great thing. So it's hard to have comparables. There really isn't much out there. Most attorneys who work in the state will do a combination of advice for clients, trial work, appellate work. There are a handful of attorneys who do appellate cases, and I don't have numbers of how many cases they might work on in a year, although we could probably do some calling around and get some anecdotal evidence on that. And we also don't have comparables from other state attorney general's offices because very few are organized the way we're organized. So I'm afraid we don't have good numbers for comparison on this.
Okay.
Please continue.
Thank you. I'm sorry. I saved some of these till later. I was writing them down, but it applies now. So
you're doing
if you bear
just
with
fine,
me.
Representative.
You mentioned the fact that you have good folks in your department. What is the average tenure for the attorneys practicing in the appellate division?
Madam Chair, Representative Hannah, I would have to look at what our average is for current. My guess is it's going to be somewhere between 8 and 10 years on average in the appellate division. We have some attorneys who have been there, who were there when I got there 12 years ago and were considered senior attorneys then, and they're still with us. We have, as we've been hiring and replacing attorneys who may leave, they may go to be on the appellate court. We are looking at hiring less experienced, newer attorneys, and so now the range of experience we have goes from just a couple of years out of law school to probably about 20 years experience in the appellate division.
Okay, and one last follow-up in this line.
Whatever you need to ask.
I'm wondering when folks do leave, the number one reason they're going.
Madam Chair, Representative Hannah, I think the number one reason is that we lose them to the appellate courts. The former chief judge used to refer to the appellate division as the training camp for the Court of Appeals. I don't know about that, but we do, certainly if you look at there are two former solicitor generals on the Court of Appeals, one on the Court of Appeals, one on the Supreme Court. There are two former deputies who are on the Court of Appeals. So typically it is, when I think back on the people who've left recently, it's to go to the appellate courts. We recently had someone leave to take a manager position in another part of DOJ, Department of Justice, so it was an advancement into management. And we have occasionally lost attorneys, to be honest, because a combination of the commute is a problem for people and the salary is a difficulty in retaining attorneys. When you have younger attorneys who have families starting out and may have law school bills still to be paid, retaining them with a salary freeze can be difficult. And frankly, I'm very pleased and fortunate that we haven't lost more attorneys because of that.
Thank you very much.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know if this is the right time to get into a broad discussion, but I'm interested in the amount of the workload in the criminal appeals division that's created by the death penalty.
Yeah.
And whether we're going to go into more discussion later,
yeah,
or is this appropriate now?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, I actually have a slide on that as part of the defense of criminal conviction, so we will get to that and we'll talk about the death penalty cases.
Very good.
Just to give a sense of the recent workload for the appellate division as a whole, including the defense of criminal conviction, over the last three calendar years, we assign out around 1,400 cases in a year. We end up briefing around 1,200 cases, and that averages out to about 40 cases per attorney. The other cases that the attorneys resolve, they do through something other than a brief. They may get rid of the case by a motion or some other way instead of having it go through the briefing process. The most important figure, I think, on this particular slide is that backlog per attorney. Those are the number of cases that are on the attorney's desk waiting to be briefed. So nothing has happened on those cases. And if you take a look at the end of 2002, that was around 14 cases. If you look at the end of 2004, it was up to 19 cases overall. And the biggest change on that, we've actually brought the backlog down on the civil administrative side. The backlog on the criminal side has gone up substantially. And I'll show you another slide on that when we talk about defense of criminal convictions. A of the two performance measures in the Department of Justice that our data contributes to, we do really well on one of them and not so well, I suppose, on the other. But it has to do with the kind of work that we do. We have a very high rate of wins in the appellate courts. That can change a lot if we lose a case that sort of has a ripple effect out, and it's not just one case, but it may be a whole bunch of cases that raise the same issue. So, for example, in the last 6 months of 2004, our win rate was down to about 91%, and that was in large part because we lost one case that had a number of cases linked to it, and so we lost several in one swoop. Our settlement rate is very low, and that is because most cases that are going to settle will settle before they get to the appellate court. And if our trial division is doing a good job of assessing cases and trying to settle the ones that are appropriate, the cases will be resolved at trial and they won't make it to the appellate courts. We do, however, look at ways of resolving cases where it's appropriate to resolve them without going through the appellate process. And those are hard to capture as settlements. But what that includes is sometimes if we see that a mistake was made in the trial court, if a trial judge got a sentence wrong, we will concede error, and we will simply acknowledge to the appellate court that there was a problem with the case and it needs to go back and something else needs to happen. In agency cases, we may look at an agency order and find that something happened that shouldn't have, and we'll work with the agency to withdraw that order and to fix it instead of taking the case through the appellate process and losing in the appellate courts. So we look for other ways of trying to resolve cases when we find that in fact, the state's best legal interest is met, not by trying to win the case, but by trying to do what is right. And now we're going to move quickly through some slides, and then I want to just give you a couple of examples. The factors affecting services, you've heard as part of the overview of public safety that the agencies are very interconnected. That's true for us as well. So if there are changes in other parts of the system, that's going to change our workload. And because we are so reactive, changes elsewhere can have a significant change in the kind of cases that we see. Both as a management team and as a team for the entire division, we're always looking for ways to minimize the legal cost. And typically what that is through is maximizing communication and trying to make sure that we minimize duplication of effort. So if one attorney can copy from another, you don't get extra points for creative writing in appellate. If you can do it faster by taking someone else's work, that's how we want to have it done. But at the same time, trying to make sure that the newer attorneys understand what it is they're doing and are really trained to handle the cases that they handle. We look for ways to expedite disposition of our cases, and I just want to touch on two examples here because they should help give you a better sense of how the appellate division works. The abscond that is mentioned here, the motion to dismiss for inmates who abscond, the appellate courts have a rule that if someone who is involved in the criminal justice system is not participating actively in the criminal justice system, they can't have their appeals proceed. So if someone is on parole or on post-prison supervision and they have failed to keep in touch with their probation officer, if someone has a bench warrant issued for an arrest because they have failed to appear in a trial court, then under the appellate court rules, we can ask to have any appeals that they have pending dismissed. And we had, through the work of our paralegals who kind of took this on as a project, we now review cases where that's a possibility. We'll check the criminal justice records to find out what sort of standing the person is in. And in a 22-month period, we filed 108 motions to dismiss because we found that the inmate was on abscond status. 85 of those resulted in cases being dismissed. Only 9 were denied, 4 of them we withdrew, and 10 were waiting to hear from the court. But what that translates into is about 46 cases a year that we're able to resolve the appeal without the attorneys having to do any work on those cases. And without this activity, the backlog would increase by another 1.5 cases per attorney per year. So this has been a very good project, and it's one that the paralegals have get a lot of credit for the work that they do on this. And as a final example of sort of how we work to maintain efficiency, I want to mention very briefly, cases that you're going to hear about as you go through the session this year. And it shows a lot about how appellate is reactive. We have to simply deal with changes around us. Last year, the United States Supreme Court issued two criminal decisions that really kind of rocked the world of everybody who does criminal law. The first one was Crawford, and what the court did in Crawford was to change how states can use information that's not somebody coming in and testifying, here's what happened, here's what I saw, here's what I did. And instead, where sometimes we will have information presented through a police officer who did an investigation, the court has said that in a lot of those circumstances, we can't do that. That the defendant's right to cross-examine the witness means that the state can't use that information. And just a couple of places where that has had a very large impact, if you think about domestic violence cases, often when the police are there investigating the incident, the victim will explain things about what happened. But by the time it comes around for a trial, the victim may not want to or be able to really testify. And in the past, we've been able to have the police come in and testify about what the victim said at the time of the incident. Under the Crawford decision, we can't do that anymore. And so it was a reversal, really, for the court of how they were treating that kind of evidence. And then shortly after that, they decided Blakely. And in this legislative session, you'll hear about Blakely fixes. Very short description of Blakely. What the court said was any fact that increases a sentence has to be found by the jury and cannot be found by the judge. And what the case that they had in front of them was a case out of Washington State. And essentially the court said that the Washington State sentencing guidelines were unconstitutional because the trial judge would make factual findings that would lead to an enhanced sentence. Oregon's is very similar to that. So when these cases came out, we had an immediate need to figure out what they meant. What could we tell district attorneys and judges really throughout the state for the cases that they had in front of them? And then to take a look at the literally hundreds of cases in the appellate system where these issues potentially needed to be addressed. What we did was to sit down with individuals from the Public Defender's Office, the Indigent Defense Group. We sat down with the chief judge and presiding judges in the Court of Appeals, and we worked together to figure out how we were going to process this load of cases. We don't work together to figure out advocacy on the cases. We still vigorously defend our positions. But in terms of simply how are we going to deal with this huge workload and how can we be the most efficient in dealing with it, the three groups worked very well together to identify the most significant issues that the court needed to address right away, what kind of lead cases we could pick and move through the system as quickly as possible, and then how we could put everything else on hold until we got those lead cases resolved and try to make the process move as smoothly as it can. And that's an example that was a fairly dramatic example because of the number of cases and the complexity of the issues, but that kind of thing happens on a repeated basis where the parties who are involved in this system really work together to try to make the system work the most efficiently. Let me just touch on the House Bill 3182 reductions. The reductions for appellate would be just over $1 million, and since, like most of the other legal divisions, our costs are primarily in people, if you were to translate this into, say, three attorneys, and given what our attorneys do as far as handling cases per year, that would mean 135 cases a year that we won't be able to handle. And because we've lost the flexibility in the system, that means 135 cases where the state's interest may not be represented unless we can find some other way of dealing with those resource hits.
Senator Devlin.
Just clarification so that maybe some of the newer members on the committee, I think some people saw the $1 million and the three FTE. Could you explain that? It's the three FTE, obviously, for a biennium, and you'd lose the support staff, probably.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Gavin, we could keep our attorneys a lot better if we were paying them that, but we're not. You're right, and I'm just sort of using the three attorneys as that may be one way of making some of those cuts. We always look first to, in our services and supplies part of the budget, how can we cut things out there that are going to take the first hit for any reduction? But at some point, you're cutting into your salary cost, your ability to retain attorneys. And so if, as part of that cut, you lost three attorneys, that's what it would translate into. So thank you for the opportunity to correct that. Any other questions about appellate before we move into defense of criminal convictions?
Representative Hansen and Senator Devlin, did you get your question fully addressed around the death penalty?
Well, my good colleague from the House brought the issue up, and I was thinking of the issue at the same time. Not that I'm anticipating that anything will change, but I think we had a discussion in the last session about the cost in indigent defense for capital cases and the appeals that resulted from them. And although your reaction to them may be different from what a defense attorney would be, I would think that there would be some significant costs for the Attorney General in defending those cases also.
And Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, we're going to touch on that as we shift over to defense of criminal convictions because they're one of the most significant pieces of that workload. So if we can move on into that discussion. The defense of criminal conviction is a fund that we manage within the Department of Justice. It's our general fund that pays for work of the trial division and the appellate division. So this slice in some ways really sort of overlaps with the appellate slice and the trial slice because the work that we do will bill against the money that's in the defense of criminal convictions fund. And now I get another slide that will explain how a system works. When we talk about defending criminal convictions, it's not just a single appeal. There are a number of steps that an individual can go through to challenge a criminal conviction, and I want to give you just a very brief overview of all of those different phases. The criminal case will start with the criminal conviction, and again, that's at the trial court level where the district attorneys are representing the state. From there, it will go to a direct appeal, and that starts in the Court of Appeals, and that's kind of the typical case I was describing in the Court of Appeals. Anyone who's dissatisfied in the Court of Appeals can ask the Supreme Court to review the case. And the court takes very few of those, but a considerable amount of the court's workload is in criminal cases. Once that direct appeal process is complete, the defendant can bring another challenge called a post-conviction challenge. And the difference between the direct appeal and the post-conviction is that in the direct appeal, what you're looking at is the record that was created at trial and issues that you can resolve based on reviewing that record. So it may be issues having to do with evidence that came in or didn't come in, sufficiency of the evidence, whether there was enough really for the conviction, interpretations about the law and how that might have been announced to the jury and jury instructions that were given or not given. But the challenges in the direct appeal are challenges based on the record created at trial. In post-conviction, we deal with the challenges where you actually need a new record created. The most common challenges in post-conviction are challenges saying that I had a constitutionally inadequate trial attorney or appellate attorney. And there are other kinds of challenges that may be raised in post-conviction, but those are the ones that we'll see most often. And because the only way to resolve that is really to start the process over again and to create a new record, we start over in the state trial courts. And the attorneys in our trial division will represent the state in those proceedings. From there, it follows the normal course of appeals to the Court of Appeals with discretionary review in the Oregon Supreme Court. And once we get through the state review, through the direct appeal and the post-conviction, then the individual can move to the federal courts and ask for a review. There's a limitation in the federal courts. They can only ask for review of issues that are based on federal law or the federal constitution. And those issues have to have first been presented to the state courts. The federal courts have to give the state courts a first fair opportunity to address and resolve these issues before they can look at them, with some exceptions. And again, we're starting with a new record. We're starting in the federal trial courts. The defendants are typically represented by the federal version of indigent defense, the Federal Public Defender's Office. And from there, the case can go to the Federal Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, which is our appellate court. And at the bottom of all of these columns is the United States Supreme Court that can review cases from any of these. And in the past, our workload in the United States Supreme Court has been so small that it doesn't even show up as a bubble on this kind of slide. That's increasing some. And I am proud to say our Attorney General argued a case in the United States Supreme Court in December of 2003 and did an excellent job. And we won that case 8-1. And United States Supreme Court work is very special work for any state attorney. It's also very costly work. We don't do it unless it's an issue that is of great significance to the state. The case that the Attorney General argued was a federal habeas case. And if we had simply let the law stand the way the Ninth Circuit announced it, it would have had dramatic impacts in terms of the cost of defending federal habeas cases in a number of cases. And so because we thought the Ninth Circuit was wrong and because of the potential impact on cost for us in future cases, we took the case to the United States Supreme Court. And we now have actually a number of other petitions pending in cases, two federal habeas cases, where we are asking the United States Supreme Court to review other decisions. And those are very, very costly cases. And one other thing I'll point out on this slide, because we're going to talk about death penalty cases, is often when you hear discussions about the death penalty review process, people will talk about how many opportunities there are to challenge a death penalty conviction. And in fact, the opportunities to challenge a death penalty conviction differ in only one way from a non-death penalty conviction, and that is that the death penalty conviction has one less step available to the inmate. And it's because at the very starting point, the review from the criminal conviction does not start in the Court of Appeals but goes straight to the Oregon Supreme Court. Otherwise, the review available to the defendant is the same in a death penalty case as it is in a non-death penalty case. If you take a look at our expenditures for the current biennium and project them into 2005-2007, this is how they break out as far as how the different kinds of cases that we handle. Most of the work is in the direct appeal with sort of a decreasing amount of work as you go to a post-conviction trial, post-conviction appellate, federal habeas trial. The amount of the cost of it goes back up again, although the numbers actually are fairly small. The cost of defending cases in federal habeas is much higher than it is in state post-conviction or direct appeals. I'm giving you a sense of kind of the numbers of cases we're talking about. The next slide shows post-conviction cases in the trial courts. And again, probably the most important thing on this slide is that black line that is increasing, and that's the trend line for the cases that are pending. These are cases where attorneys may be working on them, and they're in different parts of the process in the trial court, but that they haven't been resolved, and that continues to grow. And as that continues to grow, for the trial attorneys as well as for appellate attorneys, there comes a point where if you don't have the resources to handle some of those that are pending, the trial courts are going to say, you know, state, essentially you're not here, and so we're going to resolve the case without you. The next slide shows the federal habeas cases in the trial division. And again, the important line is that the black trend line that shows the number of cases pending in the trial division. The federal habeas cases are increasing, although we're not having a sharp increase in the number that we're opening. We're not able to resolve them, and so they're building up in the system. The next slide shows the appellate workload. And in the back of your book, there's a sort of a slightly expanded version of this slide that actually has the numbers attached to it. The important thing here is to note that trend, actually it's not a trend line, it's an actual line, of the backlog for attorneys, that we've gone from a backlog of around 15 cases per attorney up to about 23 cases per attorney of criminal cases. And this is just our criminal FTE that we're looking at. And part of that, there is actually a line at the top of these. It's very small, and so it's hard to see, but that's the death penalty cases. And a very small increase in death penalty cases will have a huge impact on our ability to process cases because of the amount of time that's involved in those. And I'll get into more detail on the death penalty cases in a moment. The next slide shows some of the measures that we use to see if we're being efficient in handling our cases. One of those is that we keep track of how many hours we spend on each case. Direct criminal appeals, that has stayed fairly constant at around 43 or 44 hours per case on average. Some an attorney may be able to do in a couple of hours, and some may take several weeks to handle. Post-conviction cases have increased slightly, but they're typically easier to handle than a direct appeal. For federal habeas cases, we have brought down the amount of time that it takes us to handle those on average by a considerable amount. I think the reason for that decrease is because we stole one of the attorneys from the trial division who is very experienced in this area, happens to also be a very good writer and is a terrific appellate attorney. But what we got out of that was a lot of experience in being able to quickly handle federal habeas cases. And what we're now trying to do is to use that experience so that some of our less experienced attorneys can learn from what she's doing. And now we'll talk about the death penalty cases for a moment. The death penalty cases are very slow to move through the system. And because we've got these different avenues of challenging cases, what's happening is the death penalty cases are building up in the system as we have new cases coming in, and we're not able to get them moving through the system. And what you'll see on this slide, if you look at the purple bars, those are the death penalty cases that are in the post-conviction trial court. And that is one of the biggest places right now where the cases are simply backing up and they're not going anywhere. For the direct appeals in the Oregon Supreme Court, we have timelines that are set by the court, and so the cases can't back up. We are directed to make those a top priority for our caseload. It still takes us a long time to brief them, but we end up getting those cases moving through the direct appeals fairly quickly. I think we could do better, but we're doing okay there. But when they get to the post-conviction court, unless the trial court really pushes the parties and says, you've got to get these things moving, then the defendant doesn't usually have a strong interest in moving them through. And the state, if we don't have the resources to push them through, we tend to let those kind of sit as we try to move some of the other hundreds of cases we've got in post-conviction trial courts. And so far, the trial courts have not put a lot of pressure on us to move the cases through because their resources are also limited and they've got a lot of cases to handle.
Senator Devlin.
Before my colleagues trying to think that I'm trying to speed up the appellate process in this, is it true, or maybe it's not entirely true, that one of the discussions we got into that is in capital cases, it would be just most common to appeal on these two, in terms of post-conviction relief in the habeas cases, to do them consecutively, even if you could do them concurrently, because of the amount of time that would be held up into the appeal to do if you did them consecutively?
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, the difficulty I see in trying to sort of overlap the process for death penalty cases or for any other criminal cases has to do with what I mentioned when I was describing the federal habeas cases, that the only issues the federal courts can look at are those that were first presented to the state court. And because of that, an individual has to exhaust all of the state court possibilities before they can raise an issue in federal habeas. We could say, you know, that's okay with us. You don't have to do that. But I think at a considerable cost to the state, if we tried to move it along and actually start things in federal habeas before we had fully worked through the state avenues of review.
Follow-up, Madam Chair.
Please continue.
I think in our previous discussions, and I've had these discussions both in the Ways and Means process and in the Rules Committee when I was a Rules Committee member, I think the thing that was interesting is when you look at the amount of resources in terms of both on the state side, both state sides actually, but on the Department of Justice's side and on the Indigent Defense side, and you look at the relatively, I won't say relatively, that's a bad word to use, I don't know how many we currently have that have been sentenced. I believe it's probably in the low 30s now.
I believe that's right.
And but it's very interesting, regardless of your position on the death penalty, that since the death penalty was instituted, and I know this may not feel like an accurate statement, the two parties that actually have been executed since it's been instituted are the two parties that virtually, in a sense, volunteered because they waived their appeals. Other than that, I don't think anyone has gotten to the end of that process yet, and they may get to that relatively in the next couple of years, given the age of some of the cases, but it is an interesting aside to this, that basically the two people that have faced the ultimate sanction by the state are people that volunteer. That's not maybe a great way to say it, but I mean in the sense that they waived all their appeals.
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, that's correct. The two individuals who have been executed since we reinstated the death penalty, they did not go through the post-conviction process. They did not go through the federal habeas process. They have to go through that first direct appeal to the Oregon Supreme Court. The rest of it is optional. If you take a look at this slide, you'll see that we're actually not very far along in moving any other case close to that. Okay. We've gotten a couple of cases now through the post-conviction appellate process, which should mean that we're just now starting the federal habeas part of it, and in fact what's happened is their federal habeas public defenders have backed up and tried to start the state post-conviction process over again.
Madam Chair, yes. Just a minor follow-up, just so the committee members, I think I know the general range of years, but I think you would know the specific year that the death penalty was reinstituted in the state.
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, I want to say 1989. So, and if you look at this, and you look at, if you were to add these.
Before you continue, I'm getting another year behind you.
Well, I was going to be one of those answers, so I would always go with the Attorney General for the answer. I'll correct that statement and say 1984.
Okay.
So I have to pay him.
I'll take 18 years, 18, 19 years.
Almost 20. Well, over 20 now.
And are you about ready to wrap up?
Yes, yeah. I am.
I'm sorry, my older gentleman here is right. Almost, is 84 is 20.
It was intense.
I will yield to more senior 20. In terms of years.
Let me just point out a couple more things quickly on the death penalty slide. If you look at our trend line for hours worked on the cases, it's going up. We're putting resources into these cases, but what is not happening is we're not able to move the cases really through the system. They're backing up in the system. If you were to add up the bars and sort of stack them all on top of each other, what you would find is that we've gone from around 30 cases in the system for several years to a jump between 2003 and 2004 to 40 cases in the system. And that number is only going to climb, and part of that is because the issues that sent a number of death penalty cases from the Oregon Supreme Court back to the trial courts, most of those issues have now been resolved. And so a death penalty case doesn't have the same kinds of issues that it had when we first had the death penalty in the state. But let me just point out to you also that we are being more efficient in handling the cases on direct appeal. In 2002, we spent an average of 982 hours for a death penalty direct appeal. In 2004, that's come down to 566 hours, but that's still a lot more than what a regular non-death penalty direct appeal will take. And the least complex death penalty case is likely to take us more time than the most complex non-death penalty case.
Final question, Madam Chair.
Certainly.
And then I'll leave this issue.
Thank you.
How would you compare the appellate work in a death penalty case to a true appellate work in a life without possibility of parole?
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, the attorneys involved in working on the death penalty cases feel a greater obligation to raise every possible issue in the case. The amount of time that is spent in the trial courts is considerably longer, from picking a jury to handling the case and doing the sentencing phase, so there's a lot more opportunity for issues to arise. I actually have a, you know, if we're talking about briefs, this is a sample respondent's brief in a death penalty case compared to one in a regular criminal case. And this one, I think, it's up to about 250 pages. So in a regular case, even a life without parole aggravated murder case, we may see 6 or 8 issues raised. In a capital case, we may see 40 issues raised. And that's the difference. And we're seeing that even in cases where there may not be much to litigate at the point of the appeal. But they certainly do take a lot more resources for everybody's part in the system.
Madam Chair. Just a comment. Why I bring up these issues is because it's often an item of discussion in the building. I've said to people that unfortunately I actually believe in the death penalty in some cases, but when people try to make the arguments somehow, and this seems like a terrible argument to make, but I've heard this argument, that in terms of cost to the public and cost to the system, that the death penalty is less expensive than life imprisonment, that's a totally invalid argument, and I just wanted to make that case. So, because the cost is incredible, actually, in terms of the cost to the state.
We do need to wrap up.
I have one last slide, then, that just shows...
Representative. Okay. In light of Senator Devlin's questions, could you estimate how much of your budget is actually eaten up by death penalty cases?
We can provide that for you.
Okay. Thank you.
And just to look at the reductions, and these are the reductions in general funds that are on top of the reductions that we had through the special session and on top of the reductions in the governor's budget, $1.2 million in general funds. And if if this turns out to mean fewer attorneys working on these cases, then we're likely to take that reduction in appellate cases more than in trial court cases, because if we don't appear in the trial courts, the state loses. If we don't appear in the appellate courts still have an obligation to review the case and to reach a decision about the case. And what that means is that there may be a reduction in resources for us, but going back again to that public safety overview and how the agencies are interrelated, if we're not doing our work, the appellate courts have to do our work. And so it really isn't a savings for the state. It's a shifting of costs from us to the appellate courts. And that's my last slide, so close on time.
Thank you very much for the presentation and the thoroughness and your responses to the questions and comments. We will move next to the Child Support Division. And Cindy, is it Chinnock?
Chinnock.
Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Cindy Chinnock, the director of the Child Support Program in Oregon, and the division administrator for the Division of Child Support in the Department of Justice. I'm going to give you a brief overview of the Child Support Program, including the history, mission, structure, services, and caseload, and focus on performance measures. Just briefly, in the history, the program was established in 1975 as a welfare recovery program. In the 1980s, it began to shift from recovery to a combination of support to families. And then finally, by the early 2000s, now, we are primarily an income support program for families. You see the mission on the screen, and this mission reflects the change, and you can see that it's centered on what we do for children and families. It is a federal, state, county partnership with the Federal Office of Child Support Enforcement, providing funding, some of the funding for the program, but also setting many of the requirements for us to maintain a qualified state plan for the child support program. As far as the state services, Department of Justice has had full responsibility for the child support program since July
of 2003, and that was as a result of a bill passed by the legislature in the last session. Then the state contracts with 28 of our 36 counties to provide services in what we call private cases, and basically that just means those are cases in which the parents have not received any public assistance, have never received public assistance. Our structure, you'll see, is within the department. The child support program director, and then the Division of Child Support. The division carries out the state responsibilities and is organized into three sections. Those sections are the state operations, program assistance, which includes information technology, and policy, rules, legislation, and budget. And then on the left-hand side of the chart, you see district attorney liaison. There is a dotted line, and I don't know how apparent that line is dotted. The DA liaison, district attorney liaison, is not an employee of the Department of Justice, but is a member of the leadership of the program and is the liaison with those 28 counties who have a piece of the program in their district attorney's office.
I'm unclear then on the district attorney liaison reports to whom?
Madam Chair, the district attorney liaison reports to the Oregon District Attorney Association and is the employment is through Marion County District Attorney's Office. But the person is located in our office and participates in all the decision-making and direction for the program.
Thank you.
And then you'll see on this slide that there's a reduction in the governor's recommended budget of 27.67 FTE, and as a matter of fact, 22.67 of that is actually a shift from the Division of Child Support to another division, Administrative Services, and the other five were positions that were authorized and held in the e-board, at which we never requested. So that's the makes up the total of the reduction. The next slide shows the funding of the child support program and includes a slide you've seen before, expenditures by program. You'll see that the child support program is 41% of the Department of Justice overall budget. The revenue for this program is the other pie on the screen. It's 56% federal funds to the state. That's the largest single funding source, and 14% federal funds to the counties, which is the green segment of that pie. So the combination there, you'll see the federal government is paying for a large percentage of the cost of this program. Then you have 20% other funds, which is a combination of recoveries. I'll explain that in a minute, and incentives. The recoveries are collections we make on active assistance cases, that is, where the parent is receiving temporary assistance to needy families funding, and during the time they are receiving that assistance, they assign their child support to the state, and as we collect that, it becomes part of the funding for the program. That recovery is shared with the federal government. It's not all retained by the state. It's shared because they also share in the funding of the program. And then the incentives are performance-based incentives paid by the Federal Office of Child Support Enforcement based on currently five performance incentive measures in which would they monitor all states, and actually it's 54 states, jurisdictions, including the territories and Washington, D.C. So these are additional performance payments paid to the program, and there are some limits on how we're able to spend that money. It has to be for program improvement and not for the general operation of the program. And then finally, 10% general fund. Now, let me move into the services of the program. And this is split into two slides so that it's a little easier to see. To begin with, we have approximately 253,000 cases in the child support program in Oregon. And this is a significant number because when you think about a case, a child support case, it's not a case that you have for 2 or 3 years, but as a matter of fact, if it starts at the time of the birth of the child, you'll have that case for 18 to 21 years, depending on if they attend college. And this includes cases not only in-state, but also there are interstate cases where one parent leaves and moves to another state. So we're working in partnership with other states on a regular basis.
Does cases equal families?
Madam Chair, the cases can equal a family. It depends on, you know, how you look at this. The cases are very complex in the sense that you might have one obligor, the obligated parent, non-custodial parent, with a number of cases in the sense of children with different mothers. You also may have, in the case of a referred case from Department of Human Services where a child's in foster care, where each parent, there may be two cases for one child. So it's a combination. But we actually start a case at a point of either a referral from a partner agency within the state or an application. And most of our cases come as referrals. The referrals will come from the Department of Human Services because a parent has applied for assistance of one sort of or another. That could be temporary assistance to needy families, foster care, child welfare, could be Oregon Health Plan, or daycare services. And Oregon Youth Authority also refer cases to us for us to work. Once we have a case, if it comes as an application, there's an application process. It's a dollar fee to apply, not a significant cost to apply. And then also any court judgment is reported and referred to us. The next step is to locate the absent parent, the non-custodial parent. We use locate services, a variety of databases, including the federal parent locate service, which is the database maintained by the federal government based on employers reporting new employees. And every state is required to get those reports from employers within the state and then forward those to the federal government. They maintain this federal parent locate service for the purposes of support enforcement. After we've located, then we establish paternity. Most of the paternities are established through voluntary acknowledgement. We also have administrative process to establish paternity and, if needed or requested, DNA testing.
Right.
Upfront discovery is the last piece of the last step on this slide, and this is the point at which we make an attempt to make contact with each parent, gather information, financial and family information, employment information, and other information that will help us to establish the order. And on the next slide, you see that the yellow box at the top is that process. Our goal is to establish an order that is appropriate for the situation given the income and the family circumstances for both parents. We use guidelines which are in the Oregon Administrative Rules and are reviewed through quite an extensive process every 4 years and adjusted occasionally in between those four-year reviews to reflect the economic situation both in the Northwest, and we have economic studies looking at costs of raising children that are national as well. We use an administrative process, which is something that Oregon is very well known for. We're looked to as probably the model for the effective use of administrative process in establishing orders. This means that the employees of the Division of Child Support and the District Attorney's offices can establish an order through an administrative process, register it with the court, and it has the full force and effect of a court order. It's quicker and less costly and easier for customers in terms of access. All of our orders include a provision for income withholding. Now, this is really important in that we partner with employers across the state and in other states. And employers have a significant role. They're a significant partner to us in this program. Nationally, 70% of all child support is paid through income withholding. So you can see how significant that is. I don't have the statistics for Orient at this point, but that is, without the income withholding process, it would be a bigger challenge for us to...
Could we get that information, the Oregon statistics?
Madam Chair, certainly.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hanna.
May I follow up on that? Could you also, as you ascertain the information about the amount or the percentage that's collected through employment, could you also tell us the maximum fee allowable for deductions?
Madam Chair.
By the employer.
Representative Hanna, I'd be glad to get that.
And Senator Devlin.
Thank you. Madam Chair, just a couple of questions. You gave a number of case figures before that was like 200 and how many thousand?
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, it was 253,000 cases.
We should be doing these outside of state, but because of the compacts that are in place, do we know how many of those are out-of-state cases that we are pursuing here?
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, I'll follow up. I do have that, but just not with me.
But the reason I brought that up is that 253,000, while that is your actual caseload, I was just remembering a statistic that we were looking at the other day. Well, is that in 2000, we had about 850,000 children in the state between the ages of 0 and 17. It would be interesting to know how many of those children are actually part of your cases that are Oregon children. It's even if 100,000 of them are out of state, which I understand, which is a very good thing that we pursue people out of state, that's an incredible percentage.
Madam Chair and Senator Devlin, we will follow up and get more data for you.
Thank you. Please continue.
Okay. Once we have the order established, we then go on to process payments, and the payments for all cases, whether they are handled by the district attorney's offices or the state offices, all payments are processed by a state disbursement unit that receive and disperse all those payments to families. And then another item that's very important in maintaining appropriate orders is the modification process, that the situation for families changes, income levels change, employment status changes, even the custody of where the children are, which parent the children are living with, change. And at each one of those points where it's a significant change, we need to modify the order to represent, to continue to have an appropriate order for the situation. When there is no payment of child support, we'll go to the next slide. It's another significant part of our process. This slide demonstrates our overall goal, and our overall goal is that parents are able and willing to support their children. Now, there are a variety of reasons why we would find parents not supporting children, and you see one of the large categories is that parents are unable to pay support. They may be unable to pay support because they are unemployed currently. They might have just been laid off. They may be unemployable because of mental health or addiction issues. They may be incarcerated and unable because they have no income, or they may be disabled. In those cases, we are looking to refer them to services that we don't have and can't provide directly, but that may help them overcome some of these barriers, and still with the goal to get them to the point that they would be able to pay the support for their children. The other large category for those who are not paying are those who are unwilling. They have the resources, but for some reason or another may be unwilling to pay. And these could be reasons such as they believe the order is not fair or appropriate. Their income may have changed, and they really are sort of struggling in that it's not appropriate for their current situation. There may be relationship issues with the other parent, or they may be feeling that they shouldn't have to pay support for a child when they're not allowed to have time with that child. And in those cases, we both would be looking to remove those barriers and help through services that we could refer them to or through services we can provide. We'd modify the order if appropriate. But in many of those cases, what it is that we need to use the enforcement tools that are available to us in this program to help them reach their responsibility and pay the support that they owe. And you see listed on the screen a number of tools that we use to enforce support. Even when we're going to these enforcement means, we are still working towards the goal of having parents who are able and willing to provide support and are not looking to punish parents, but to give them the incentive they need to pay the support. The next slide refers to the federal, or it's actually the National Child Support Enforcement Strategic Plan, which was adopted this past October, and it's a five-year plan that is a national plan. It's not the federal plan. It's not a particular state's plan. It's intended to be for all programs across the country. And this plan is significant in that it continues to set the direction nationally for the program, and there are four themes in this plan. You see them there on the screen. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that, but I will say that Oregon has been recognized as a leader and a model by the commissioner, by the former commissioner of the Federal Office of Child Support Enforcement, and is held up to other states as a place to go to learn more about how to do these things more effectively. Then we move on to performance measures. And you see that there are four performance measures that are numbered and that are part of the document, the budget document, 137, 10, 11, 12, and 13. I have a separate screen for each of these. But before we move on, let me just say that there are, in these measures, in three of these measures, there's a federal benchmark, and that's because three of these measures are also incentive measures at the federal level. And the benchmark is, it was established by Congress, and it's the point at which the state becomes eligible for incentives. So, we'll move to the first one. This is the percentage of the collections in Oregon that are distributed to families. And it supports the mission, as you saw earlier. The federal distribution rules have changed, and that has helped to push this number up. And there are a variety of other changes, policy changes, that help to continue to see this as a family support program. Also, cost avoidance is a real motivator to do this, in that if we can ensure that families who are leaving assistance, like temporary assistance to needy families, are getting regular child support, the chances are they'll be able to stay off of public support. In 2004, Oregon was at 92%. The national average is 90%, so we're above the national average. The next slide shows the percent of child support that's paid on time. And this is significant when you think about reliable income, in that if it's not being paid on time, obviously families are going without. Not only that, but the balance on unpaid child support is going up, and that's significant because nationally that is approaching $100 billion, and much of it's uncollectible. As time goes by, it's just more and more uncollectible. So we do monitor this, and this is a priority for us. The federal benchmark here is 40%. Oregon is about 59%, and the national average is around 58%. Challenges in this, and you see a little bit of a dip on this chart, we've had the dubious distinction of having high unemployment in this state, and certainly that and the slow recovery have affected our ability to continue to see this number go up, but we continually look for ways to make sure that we're doing all we can to see that number increase. The next,
I have a question for you. Can you tell us how these performance measures relate or align with what is going on out there in the counties, the 28 counties that are part of this system.
Madam Chair, these numbers include the county performance, so we're looking at program-wide in the state, and they are actually the county's performance, for instance, in the terms of the percentage of child support that's paid on time, is higher because the nature of the cases between the counties and the state is different. Most of the county cases are those that where rather than being a child of an unwed situation, the divorce decrees that go to the district attorneys and counties to enforce generally. There was a family, an intact family at one point in time, and so the percentage of collection is higher. The income level of those cases, generally speaking, also is higher.
And what I'm trying to get at is if whether the performance measurements are the same, if we're using the same assumptions and the same data analysis, if there's alignment in the two systems.
Madam Chair.
One system.
Madam Chair, it's a single system, and the standards are the same across the program.
All right. Representative Hansen, and then Senator Devlin.
Real quickly, you mentioned $100 million or $100 billion uncollected amount. What part of that would be, are you have a ballpark number for what's owed in the state of Oregon?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, I should know that number, and I don't offhand, but I certainly will get it for you.
Okay.
There's some information in the performance measurement document that I believe you all received, performance measure links to Oregon benchmarks for public safety agencies, and there's an indication on page 25 of the document, which is related to the Department of Justice, that about 60% of child support that's due in Oregon is paid.
Yes.
Okay, I let's see.
So, Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, I understand your question to be of that national amount of unpaid child support. What is Oregon's number, dollars that are currently mm-hmm. overdue, mm-hmm. past due?
Can I get a clarification? Because I believe there are probably exceptions to this, but my general understanding has been that the Department of Justice, in pursuing child support cases, is principally pursuing those in which public assistance of some type has been an issue, and the district attorneys are principally pursuing those where it's public assistance is not an issue and it's simply just a collection from someone that's not paying. Is that a fair?
Madam Chair and Senator Devlin, that's exactly correct. Okay. The cases that the counties are working are cases in which there's never been any public assistance, and the cases that the Department of Justice Division of Child Support works are those in which there is currently or formerly was some sort of assistance to the families.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Just a request, actually. Members in this building, we get probably one or two requests a month in my office on child support issues, and I've always thought it would have been beneficial for your division to send a letter out to members informing of them, I don't know the proper terminology for it, but your child support desk, because it's been very helpful in terms of providing information. It's a fairly complex area, and it's been very helpful to our office in terms of being able to provide assistance to constituents.
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, we'll be sure every member has that constituent services team phone number and the names.
Please continue.
All right. The next slide shows the percentage of cases in which there have been collections on the past due support. The federal benchmark here is 40%. Oregon has reached 61.2%, and the national average is 59.8%. So we are somewhat above the national average in getting collections on past due support. The next slide shows the percentage of cases with an order for support. The federal benchmark is 50%. Oregon is at 68% in the national average. And here's one in which we are below the national average is 72%. The caution I have is that in some states, and this is not to be critical, but in some cases, orders are taken where there is no specific information known about the income situation. Income is imputed and default orders are taken. And in some of our neighboring states, the percentage of arrearages or past due support have increased at a rate that's far in excess of Oregon because we put such a focus on appropriate orders up front and that we take more time then to establish that order. In addition, there are just some cases in which there will never be an order. There are some cases that are referred to us where the family is receiving medical only services from the Department of Human Services, and there's no requirement for them to cooperate and give us any information in order to establish that order. And then there are other cases in which we're just totally unable to locate a parent. There are cases in which the mother has no idea who the father is, and there are cases, and in those cases we can't establish paternity, we will never establish an order. So there are a number of reasons for this number being lower than one might expect. The next slide shows our total collections, and you can see that the total collections, this is each bar is for biennium, continues to grow, even with the economy. Part of this is due to more and more enforcement through automated techniques. Part of it is through the changes in the program that has given us more enforcement tools. And part of it is through the dedication and hard work of all those case managers who are working these cases every day. The total biennial collections for this current biennium is expected to be about $549 million, and for next biennium, about $571 million. You can see that on this chart, the small blue box at the bottom is the amount that's retained for federal and state recoveries to offset the cost of assistance, and the balance goes to families, which is consistent with the first chart you saw. One other thing I'd like to mention, that's cost effectiveness. The Oregon program cost effectiveness ratio, which is a federal measure, is, and this is 2003 data, we don't have the audited 2004 data yet, was 5.6. The national average is 4.32, and Oregon is one of the top 10 most cost-effective programs out of the 54 jurisdictions that are measured on this measure. We're very proud of that and believe that, you know, we're making choices, the tough choices with limited resources to do the best job we can in this program. We are also required to do a federal self-assessment. There are 9 process and timeline measures to make sure that we're responsive to customers, and those we exceed all 9 of those measures. My last slide is the House Bill 3182 reductions, and you'll see here that the total of the reduction, the impact of this reduction would be a reduction of 60 employees in the Division of Child Support, which amounts to a loss of $62 million for families, $3 million in recoveries for the state, and a loss of $3 million in revenue for the district attorneys, which includes a combination of the federal match rate, which goes through our budget, so a 10% reduction would reduce that, but also the incentives would be reduced through this. It's sort of that cycling. If you reduce the performance, you're going to reduce the incentives.
Thank questions you. Or comments? Representative Hannah and then Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to back up a ways, and I wrote the question down. Do I understand from the slide that shows the 92.1% collection that we're keeping roughly 8% of collected support for administration?
Madam Chair and Representative Hannah, we do retain on those cases that are currently receiving assistance, the child support is assigned to the state and it's retained to pay for part of the cost of the program.
that difference.
That yes.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Wisnett.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I guess, do the circuit court judges, do they look at the person that's supposed to provide the child support's ability to pay when they make these decisions, I'm assuming, because at a certain point, you know, you can scare them out and start them on the run, and they get them in too bad of a situation. And as Senator Devlin said, a lot of my constituent issues address this, and I've had a recent case where constituent called and his wife was falsifying the fact that her son was in college so they could continue to draw payments. Do you look at that? Does someone else look at that as far as fraud? Thank you.
Madam Chair and Representative Wisnett, we do whatever information we can gather in terms of both modifying the orders and looking at the issue of compliance with the information required. We do that both administratively, and if it is a case that goes before the court, the judge also would be asking those questions. Every case is so unique that it's not just like putting a couple of numbers into a calculator and the answer comes out at the end. We do have to spend time asking those questions.
Members, we need to move to the next presentation, but I would suggest that if there are additional questions or comments for the agency, that we put those in writing, and we'll look forward to getting those responses back. Thank you for the thoroughness of your presentation. Congratulations for being in the top 10, and please share that with the other folks back in the agency doing the hard work. Our next presentation is Administrative Services Division. Frank, is it Pescia?
Pescia, that's correct, Madam Chair.
Good afternoon to you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Frank Pescia. I'm the Director of Administrative Services. I realize time is kind of the essence today, and we're running a little bit behind, so I'm going to try and speed up a little bit and see if I can get through this in enough time to continue on to the rate presentation so that there's adequate time for that.
Thank you.
The administration in the Department of Justice is actually broken up into two parts. There is the Office of the Attorney General, which includes the Attorney General and his direct staff, and the functions they perform in directing the Department of Justice, establishing the state's legal policy, representing the state, of course, in high-profile legal cases, and the center of law for the state, and a number of other functions assigned to the Attorney General's office. The other part of administration is the Administrative Services Division. And the Administrative Services Division mission is really to provide the centralized business support for the agencies and programs. Kind of real-life examples, if I could just take a second to mention a few of these things. We are the grease that sort of runs the wheels of justice from all the different administrators that you've listened to that are on the front lines working with the law. We support and are the people behind them that make it all work. For instance, when General Counsel has a public law conference, we're the folks that take care of the financial aspects of collecting the money, doing the banking, paying the fees if there's any facilities used, organizing that, the photocopying, purchasing materials for handouts. When the Child Support Division office, say in a Medford location, is overcrowded, they can't get adequate staff in the location, they notify us. We work with DAS facilities. We jointly find the location for them. We design the layout. We oversee the installation of equipment, any moves, any of that needs to be taken care of. in criminal justice calls and asks how to proceed because they found a new federal program to leverage some resources to fight crime in Oregon. Upon approval of the Attorney General, we provide the initial budget advice. We provide and establish the financial and budget infrastructure, if that's the direction it goes. We offer them and assist them with recruitment of staff or any facilities or new office space or computers and all that that happens. When an attorney calls, one of the attorneys working in what we may have is the largest law firm in the state, somewhere around 225 attorneys, and who has painstakingly been working on a brief for 4 hours and has just lost it into the ether on their computer, our IS staff run to the rescue, work with the attorney, and try and resurrect that document so that the attorney doesn't have to recreate the whole thing all over again. Those are some of the everyday examples of how we work behind the scenes to kind of make the wheels of the entire department kind of run smoothly. Administrative services is organized into four functional areas, as shown in the org chart: information services, human resources, fiscal services, and operations. You'll see that we have a net change of 25 positions. That net change results from what Cindy Shinnok had mentioned from the Division of Child Support, the transfer of some IS positions that work on our Internet, not our internet, our local area network. We're consolidating those folks into one group in admin services and our major IS operation. Two other positions there were just holdover positions from the actual transfer of the child support program to Department of Justice, and their accounting positions that came over for some of the accounting work that had to be done. The portion of the department fiscally that administration is about 5%. It's about $13.4 million. We have approximately 112 positions. Talking a little bit about some of the breakout of the various areas in administrative services. Fiscal services is the financial arm of the administrative services division and really the financial arm of the agency. They provide accounting services. In that, we have the typical day in and day out routine with a fairly high volume of accounts payable. There's about 40,000 disbursements annually. Cash receipts on a monthly basis, we account for about $7.5 million. And on payroll, which is about $4.1 million on a monthly basis, and about 1,225 people. The next...
Representative Hanson.
Very quickly. A couple sessions back here with the cash flow problem. Has that been resolved, or are people paying... Are the other departments paying you in a timely manner?
Chair Gorley, Representative Hanson, yes, in fact, that is our performance measure. And if I could have your patience for just about 1 minute, I'll get right to that point. This graph just is a volume graph, one of just one that I wanted to bring out in terms of showing through the growth of the Department of Justice. Also, the infrastructure growth in workload behind the scenes has also increased. You can see starting from 1998, we had just kind of a gradual increase, somewhat tapered off around 2002 and 2003 to a steady level. Then with bringing on the child support program, starting in 2003, our transaction growth started to go up again. And I'm not sure where that's going to stabilize, but that's just an indication of workload measures that we have. The next area I'd like to cover, forgot about budgeting. Another area within fiscal services we have, those folks would not be happy if I forgot them. We provide budgeting, and that includes some financial planning, some forecasting. This has become more and more important, especially in the economic conditions that we have, the various cases, situations where we've had to have some reductions in some program areas, reforecasting how the particular program is going to survive, what their costs are, if they need to make some decisions. We have to kind of tee up all that information for them so they can have data in order to make some management decisions about their program and their cost structures. Operations is another fairly big area for the department. It's not in staff-wise, but in terms of workload. DOJ occupies statewide about 300,000 square feet. Only about 60,000 of that is in state-owned space. We have 28 locations around the state. That creates not only some real challenges in terms of making sure that you've got all these different leases under control, you're tracking when the leases are up, what the facility is like, if there are facility issues within there. Keeps a lot of our folks very busy. Renovation projects, we are currently housed the Attorney General's office in the Justice Building along with the Appellate Division and the Trial Division. Trial Division will be moving to the Commerce Building, which is across the railroad tracks, and the building will be remodeled. The Justice Building is being remodeled. That's causing a lot of moving. We're coordinating with DAS facilities, and that is a very big project that is being taken on. Contract management, just to give you an idea, even though we review contracts for others, we also have 255 contracts of our own that we have to take care of and manage and make sure that we're tracking. And those contracts mainly deal with situations where we have special assistant attorney generals, or we have special witnesses that are brought in for court trials. Some of these folks we have to fly in from out of state. Other areas of operations are purchasing, supplies. Library services is another area that is somewhat unusual that you don't find. That is because, as the administrators that have come before me, for instance, Don Arnold, the general counsel, has talked about his public law conference or public law manuals, contract manuals, and also in Criminal Justice Division where they talk about trial manuals and search and seizure manuals. We get requests for those manuals, and we have to be able to produce them and then ship them out, receipt money for the payment of those, and collect. And we do that about 5,000 of those in a biennium. Human Resources provides personal assistance to the agency in recruitment, safety, workers' compensation, advice to managers with compliance. And we have 3 union contracts that we have to offer advice to various managers throughout the agency. The next area I'd like to cover is performance measure, and this is where Representative Panson, I'm going to get to your question. We have one formal performance measure for administrative services, and this is a measure where we're talking about legal billings, receivables that are collected within 30 days. Going back historically, I would tell you that the agency had a very difficult time cash flow-wise a number of years ago. In the 01 session, worked extensively with legislative fiscal and with the committee and talked about how to improve the cash flow for the department. One of the biggest issues was getting our receivables turned around. As a former business owner for 13 years, I saw this and I thought, this is a major problem in public sector. You wouldn't be in business much longer. We were at a 50% rate of collecting receivables in 30 days. We've turned that around. We are now at approximately running about a 75%. We set a goal in 0103 of 75%. We've generally been achieving that goal, bouncing up and down a little bit around it because we have some very large clients. And if one of those large clients were to not pay within 30 days, if they paid, say, in 45, that drops our receivables for that month down. If they pay within the 30-day period, then that bumps our receivables up. So generally, we're flowing right around 70, 75% right now. We bumped our goal up to 80%. We're working closely with the clients because it's really important I'd rather get cooperation than use a big stick, because on the other side, where we send out a survey and we talk about cooperation and what is the department doing well and not well, I'd rather be able to work with these folks and get their cooperation and see if we can speed up their process. A lot of agencies take our bill and just to give you, for instance, I did not bring a bill, but a bill can be this big because it lists all the activity from every attorney and what that attorney did at a particular time of day and the hours. And so they will distribute that information to various programs. Sometimes they have a variety of federal grants. They need to send that out. We've assisted them. And I think one of the biggest things we can do is to continue to move down this road through electronic media. We send the bills when it will at all help electronically. This enables them to kind of forward the billing electronically to their various program areas, and that helps speed the turnaround time as well. So that's helped a great deal. One of the areas, agencies that we worked with, university systems, they not only wanted it electronically, they wanted it more of a database format so they could parse it out and do some work with it. We've accommodated their request, and we send that to them in a different format. Okay. No, that slide's fine. Okay, one of the other areas I'd like to talk about is, this is our official performance measure, but behind the scenes behind this, one of the things that we have to look at also is, because these bills are so big, some of the questions you get are people out in the field at different agencies say, well, I don't remember talking to him, or what was that all about? Or you need typical kinds of questions when you see these short notes on large bills. So we have an area that just does nothing but respond to inquiries from clients. And, I mean, that's we see that as part of the service that we need to provide. What we've done is we've set a goal that we have to resolve those within 30 days. And resolving those questions within 30 days enables us to be able to turn that around, and then the client then will issue the check or issue the transfer to pay the bill. And so that works out very well. We are at about a 95% compliance with turning those things around. So within the time of before the next bill issued, we have responded to the question and we have resolved whatever it is.
Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe you can remember. Wasn't your monthly revenue $7.5 million?
That's monthly revenue from all sources.
So the $3.5 million referenced here in billing to agencies
is just a portion.
It's just that.
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to say, where's the other $4 million, or how much is left in your past due cycle?
I mean,
you would have had a whole lot left in your past due cycle, or you're not doing as much business as you thought. One of the two, right?
Sure, Gorley, Representative Hanna. Yes. Now, what I haven't explained, because I'm trying to rip through this fairly fast, is that we have a number of programs that take in revenue. For instance, there's a charities program for registration of charities that takes in revenue. There's a gaming program that takes in revenue. There's payments to our consumer protection program that takes in revenue. So we've got a variety of these different program areas where that revenue all funnels in. The $7.5 million is the kind of the general process of what we're collecting on a monthly basis from a variety of sources,
not just this.
That's correct. Okay, human resource efficiencies. I'd like to also cover just a couple things we do in other areas that are not official performance measures of DOJ, but where in administrative services we keep a strong eye on what's going on. In human resources, we are very concerned about filling positions. Filling positions does a couple things. It keeps people on the front lines helping the clients. If the client is in need of assistance and we don't have positions filled, then we have backlogs for clients. It could be in an area where there's attorneys. It could be in an area in child support. We've taken that area where we used to have a 10-week time frame. To fill a position, we've reduced it to 5. In cost containment, we're looking at reducing the number of worker compensation claims. HR has assisted the agency in reducing worker compensation claims by 27% in 2004 over what we had in 2003. Another area that HR has been very successful in is helping us minimize employee sick leave usage. That's something that you don't really see hard numbers on, but your workload tends to build because you don't have people on the job doing the work all the time. HR has been working with Human Resources, has been working with the Public Employees Benefit Board, who provides wellness sessions. They've organized wellness sessions for all DOJ locations around the state for all the various locations that we have, all 28. And DOJ is below the state average utilization.
If I could stop you just for a moment to take a question from Representative Hannah. And members, what we're going to do is continue with this presentation, wrap it up. We will get into a few minutes, perhaps, of hearing Margo Norton on the attorney billing rate. Obviously, we're going to move the diversity presentation, et cetera, into next week, just to tell you what's going on. Please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Hannah.
Madam Chair, thank you. I appreciate your patience with this.
No problem.
I think that if these items are on here as bullet points, they must be important.
Absolutely.
The workers' compensation numbers that you mentioned, do you know what your number one workers' compensation claim is, number one? And number two, are state agencies rated the same way that private business would be, i.e., do you know what your MOD rate is for your group?
Chair Verrilli, Representative Hannah, I don't know that information, but I can certainly get it for you.
Thank you.
Please continue.
Okay, the next area that I'd like to cover is information services. As I mentioned earlier, there is a policy package, and that is dealing with the technology staff that the department is moving from one division to another division. We do also have some internal goals or efficiencies that we track in this area. You're not going to find it right in this area, but I am going to mention it. We track remote access availability. We are providing now our attorneys the ability to dial in via laptop or home computer to their system here so they can do work either at home or they can do work on the road, in the field. A lot of them have to be traveling in the field, especially they travel to prisons at times, they travel to different courts. If they can plug in via a laptop or some other computer, they can access their files, they can do work out in the field with their home files. Availability of email and calendar functions, this is a really big thing, especially in the legal area, for tracking what their court dates are, where their meetings are, and availability of the department network overall. We run about a 99 percentile on this in each of these categories, and we check this on a 24/7 basis. Factors affecting service. Certainly, one of the big factors affecting service over time has been the increase in the number of facilities locations. Also, the increase in the number of special programs. We now have 22 program areas. In terms of Connie Gallagher's discussion of crime victims and crime victims' payments, we process about 170,000 of those payments on a monthly basis. And we make about 3,900 in vendor payments. Another big area of concern, and I think it's ongoing concern for all agencies, is security. I mean, as the Department of Justice, we have some connectivity to some other agencies, both federal and local. We have a strong concern and a strong emphasis on security of our systems to make sure that none of that information is tapped into. Revenue source is supported, administration in general is supported through charges to programs for central support services. A portion of the cost is allocated to each particular program or division. This is done on a basis of service used, where some programs will use more in facilities costs. Others may use more in fiscal services costs and budgeting costs. Those costs are allocated to them based on the amount of service that is used. House Bill 3182 reductions. It's approximately $1.3 million for admin services and $15,000 in federal funds. The federal fund amount relates to the school safety hotline. Because 80% of the administration costs are people-related, this reduction would impact staffing necessary to support department programs. And what this actually results in is cutting administrative staff causes the program staff that were out on the front lines now to devote or split their time between doing their frontline work, dealing with clients, and doing some of the internal agency support functions that we typically pick up for them. So that concludes my presentation, and I can't go over. I'm sorry.
No need to apologize. Thank you for going through the information with such efficiency. It was a great deal of information that you covered very well. I'm sure that if members have other questions or comments, they'll bring them forward. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Senator.
If we could introduce the subject of attorney billing rate with Margo Norton's help, and then, members, we will be spending a great deal more time on the subject later, particularly when we're in work session. But please go forward.
Yes. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Margo Norton. I'm a member of the Administrative Services Division. I have the privilege to lead a small but enthusiastic group of budgeteers. One of the tasks of our unit, as Mr. Petcha told you, is to assist the Attorney General in calculating the legal rate. As you heard, we offer a consolidated legal services model. We are the sole source of the state's of the legal services to state government. ORS 180 provides the Attorney General with the opportunity to set the rate for the services that we offer, to set up the billing process, and to establish the working capital for the agency. I'm going to answer three questions quickly. What is the legal fund? How does the billing process work? And what kind of decisions do we have to make in setting the rate? The legal fund, very simply, is an internal service fund. It's where we record the transactions, the revenues, and expenditures for providing legal services to state government. You've seen the pie of our agency, but I'd like to show you a different one. This shows the whole agency, but if we isolate the legal fund, you'll see that this is a little more than a third of the agency, second only to the Division of Child Support. It includes all of the Appellate Division, the Trial Division, General Counsel, and those portions of the Criminal Justice Division and the Civil Enforcement Division that relate to the legal services. For example, it does not include the Crime Victims Program. It does not include the Consumer Protection Group. How does our billing process work? If you look at this small slide, you will see that, as in any law firm or any business that sells goods or services, there is a process by which orders are made, services are requested. If you look at the entire chart, if Kevin will put it out, if you think in your mind the first of this month, February 1, and put that in the first box, today you need some services from the Attorney General's office. You need to have a contract reviewed. You've just received a notice, good heavens, that you're being sued. Assigned counsel. Throughout the course of the month of February, we pursue whatever it is that you've asked us to do. We have a very elaborate system for accounting for our time. We have a very extensive billing application that allows very detailed records to be provided for every customer so that they know exactly what has been worked on behalf of your agency. We generate an invoice, and now, as you get to the bottom line, started February 1, let's put March 5 in the box at the bottom. On March 5th, we will send a bill to you. And here, the importance of our performance measure, the ability to collect payment for those services within 30 days. Far end of the box, we have a good client, pays by April 5th.
you'll notice that this tracking process begins at February 1 and goes all the way through April 5. Why do we emphasize this? Why is this important? Because maintenance of this cycle is very important to the determination of our rate and also to make sure that we have adequate working capital to provide the services. So you can see the period from when work commences to the time that the bill is paid.
Ms. Gorton?
Mm-hmm.
What I am going to ask is that we stop you there.
Certainly.
In fairness to you, so that we can really have a much more thorough conversation.
Mm-hmm.
But you've piqued our interest, and we're doing our homework. We appreciate your patience very much. And again, members, we will take up the subject again. For the good of the order, I know that Doug Wilson has something he wants to share. Before we adjourn,
to make arrangements for Tuesday's tour to Coffee Creek. Actually, it's going to be a public hearing, and then the tour will follow the usual committee meeting, which will be held up there. I need to know, and I've heard from at least a couple of you, if you need a ride up and back, because I figure some of you will probably go home directly from there to Portland. And by chance, if you're not planning to take the tour, let me know that, too. If you could let me know by noon tomorrow so I can arrange transportation for Tuesday, that would be most helpful. I encourage you to take the tour if you're, because it really is taking a look at a couple things. That prison, which is a specialized function facility, but it also is the most recent large facility built and will give you an idea of the type of construction that has to take place for a prison, which you will need to be discussing here next week and the week after the Department of Corrections. So, and we'll likely try to arrange some other tours later on during the session to some of the other facilities.
Could you be a little bit more specific? What would the timeline be? I've never driven there or been there. So what time would be, and what is the date? That's February
8th. So 8th. Next Tuesday.
Next Tuesday.
We need to, the hearing will start at 1 o'clock up there. It's probably a 40-minute drive, I would guess, for the folks that drive that every day. And I can give you directions, or I can arrange transportation.
I need directions.
Okay. We go up there and then have the two-hour hearing and then take the tour after that. We'll take the hearing will be held outside of the fence, in a sense, so you don't have to go through security. But the tour, of course, will be, you'll have
where
to go through.
Where will the hearing be held then?
What?
Where will the hearing?
There's a building on the east side of the parking lot where there are some offices for non-secure parts of DOC, the sentencing computation. It'll be held in that building.
And how will the hearing be noticed? It'll be noticed here, correct?
It has already been posted or will be posted today.
And the tour will last from?
Probably from 3 to probably an hour and a half or so, I would guess. And they have both a minimum and a medium/maximum facility there, so you get to see sort of both settings.
We'll do the women's facilities and the intake center both.
Yes.
Right? Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson. And again, Ms. Norton, apologies for keeping your presentation short, but we will spend more time with you. We appreciate all of the presentations from the agency today. You guys are doing a great job. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we're adjourned.